Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Condensed Histories. I'm Jem Duduchu, and what we do is we take a piece of pop culture and we reveal the real history underneath it. And to be honest, I've been making things tough for myself over these last, I don't know, 8-9 podcasts, because it's hard to get some history out of Monopoly. That genuinely, if you haven't heard that one, I'm quite proud of the fact that I'm able to give you an entire history podcast out of the board game Monopoly. Last week, we did ABBA. And their song Money, Money, Money. The thing is, all of the ones I've done so far, Lord of the Rings, for example, they've all been about things that clearly aren't historical, but I show how there's actually a historical conversation to be had about them. But this time round, I'm going to do something in a way a little bit more obvious, but I promise I'm going to take you on an interesting journey, because this time round, I'm going to be talking to you about the book / films of Last of the Mohicans, which means we're going to have to talk about the Seven Years' War. We're going to have to talk about 19th century American settler expansion. And we're going to have to talk about films and which ones get to be remembered. Let's start things off. If you want to be literary about it, The Last of the Mohicans is written by James Fenimore Cooper. And he wrote it in 1826 of a series of historical novels, all sort of set around sort of the same time, largely with this sort of central character of Hawkeye, as he's known amongst the Native Americans that he works with and has been raised by. But his real name is Natty Bumpo, which hasn't aged well. This is because Cooper wrote Lost of the Mohicans in 1826. So people are still alive at that time who could just about remember the American War of Independence, for example. It's a very interesting time in American history. The White House was built within living memory. The British Army came in and burnt it down, or partly burnt it down, within living memory. Less than 10 years before this book was actually, or sorry, about 10 years before this book was written. So Cooper is therefore writing technically about something in the past, something that, let's say, his father and grandfather would remember better than he would. And indeed, he wasn't actually alive at the time of Last of the Mohicans. But the world hadn't changed too much since then. Like I said, an American Revolution perhaps to one side for a moment. So there's the book. And then what's interesting is it's really caught the imagination. In America, at least, the book is quite often put onto school syllabuses to be read. And just like Shakespeare might be read in the UK, it's an important piece of literature. However, it's one of a number of books, I think there's five of them in total, about this sort of era and sort of like heroes and so on and so forth. But it's only one that gets all the love. And indeed, by about 1950, there's already been about five different movies about it. So while I'm, yes, already referenced the book, already talked a little bit about the book, the reality is I'm talking about the most recent movie called The Last of the Mohicans, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and directed by Michael Mann.
Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis, Madeline Stowe. The Last of the Mohicans.
As I said at the beginning, at the start, we're going to talk a bit about movies. Because Last of the Mohicans, you might have sat there and gone, either is there a movie of that? Or did Daniel Day-Lewis really do a kind of action movie?
Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis.
Or maybe, what movie? And this is the thing. Look, Michael Mann, he is an excellent director of thrillers. And this was really in his golden patch because the movie he did just before this was a TV movie. It was relatively low budget and it was called LA Takedown. And you might sit there and go, so, Jem? Well, he then went on to do Last of the Mohicans. And then the next movie he did is the first movie to bring together two of the titans of acting, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, in this movie called Heat. This cat and mouse game between this LA detective and this bank robber, and you know, who's gonna get who kind of thing.
You see me doing thrill seeker liquor store hold ups with a Born to Lose tattoo on my chest?
No, I do not.
Right.
What's this got to do with LA Takedown? Because Michael Mann took the entire story and plot of LA Takedown, this solid TV movie, and made it as Heat, but got better actors and had a bigger budget. And Heat is considered one of the great crime capers of all time. People remember Heat. People remember The Godfather. But there are so many movies out there, really good films, that don't get remembered. And it's not even down to the actors. You're sitting there going, well, okay, Godfather Part 2 and Heat, and both of those had Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. So clearly everybody remembers their good movies. Well, no, because there's The Untouchables in the 1980s, Kevin Costner movie where Robert De Niro plays Al Capone. Interestingly, he plays Al Capone with a Brooklyn accent, which is weird seeing we're in Chicago. But anyway, that is a very, very good film. If you have not seen The Untouchables, or if it's been years since you've seen The Untouchables, then you're probably going to sit there and be very pleasantly surprised. You know, Sean Connery's career lasted decades, but he only won one Oscar, and it was for The Untouchables. Again, decided to play an Irish-American cop with a Scottish accent, much like he played a Lithuanian submarine captain as a Scottish man.
What gives you the right to fire on my ship?
He's a little limited, but he's great in that film. And it is a great movie, but Untouchables doesn't get remembered. And nor does Last of the Mohicans, even though this is a super well-shot, brilliantly directed, exciting, well-acted
Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis
tour de force of early American colonial history. Now, if you don't know the plot of Last of the Mohicans, that's okay, that's fine. But it opens up some really interesting parts of history. Going back to Daniel Day-Lewis.
Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis.
When he did this in 1992, it was actually filmed in 91, he'd already won an Oscar. And he was obviously to go on and win three Oscars. He's retired from acting once before. He is currently retired again. We'll see if he comes back again. But he's basically one of the greatest actors ever. But we don't tend to remember him as a sort of an action hero. But this is your chance to see him do that. And he does it really well. But in his usual actorly way, he was very much into method. What is a method acting? There's this guy called Stanislavski who basically says to really bring out the truth of the character, you have to get as close to the character as possible. So sort of prior to the 60s and 70s, actors would learn their lines, they'd know where they'd stand, and they acted. Whereas we get into the 60s, and particularly in the 70s, we get, well, perhaps a very famous example of this is a movie that, again, perhaps isn't that well remembered, but has some amazing acting in it. We have Laurence Olivier, and we have Dustin Hoffman in Marathon Man, where one of the great things about Laurence Olivier, another great British actor, is he did adapt his acting style. If you look at him in something like Rebecca in the 1940s, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, I mean, that's a long list of awesomeness right there. You know, he's very much acting in the very traditional sort of theatrical way of acting. And that's great. That's fine. That's how people acted in the 1940s. But, you know, when we get later into the 60s and 70s, he's really become more naturalistic. but he still comes from this point of view of acting is make-believe. And there's this famous story. The reason why I mentioned Marathon Man is because there's a scene where Laurence Olivier is torturing Dustin Hoffman for information, keeps asking, is it safe? And he's sort of like, he's using dental tools on Dustin Hoffman's teeth. It is a horrible, horribly effective scene. Not suitable for children, but it's a very powerful bit of acting. And anyway, Dustin Hoffman, because he's all into the method process, Stanislavski again, he hadn't slept for several days and he comes in, he looks awful, and it's absolutely suitable for this scene of sort of torture. But Laurence Olivier looked at him and just, you know, to the abuse he'd been giving his body, and just said to him, why don't you try acting, dear boy?
And, you know, and so Laurence looks at him, I'm like, dear boy, my God, what happened to you? I feel so bad for you. And Dustin goes, well, you know, I haven't slept for 4 days and I didn't change my clothes and I didn't take a shower. Because I said, why not? It's the part. I have to live the part. And Olivier steps back and looks at him and says, my dear boy, why don't you try acting? It's so much easier.
And if you like, that's the danger of method. You know, you can get so into it, you can start harming yourself. You know, if you're playing a destructive individual, you don't want to be destructive yourself. Daniel Day-Lewis is one of these people who very much immerses himself in the role. So he, for example, went into the forest and sort of foraged around, I think, with a sort of a survival specialist for about a month before he started filming. And he sort of wore the clothes even after takes, and he would sort of walk around with his musket all the time. Now, all of this pays off, because there is not one moment that you think that this guy from Britain is not somebody who's immersed himself in the forests of America on the frontiers and hasn't been tracking things for years. You know, it absolutely pays off. It is a remarkable performance in an absolutely great film. At the very least, at the end of all this, I hope that I'm sort of selling it hard enough for you to turn around and go, yeah, I would like to see this movie. And yes, he went on to win multiple other Oscars. Interestingly, he didn't win it for any of his historical figures. He didn't win it for Last of the Mohicans, and he didn't win it for... Oh, no, sorry, he did win it for Lincoln. Apologies, that's his most recent one. Sorry, I stand corrected. My brain just, I don't know, triggered there for a moment. Probably this is where Greg adds a sound effect of my brain falling out of my head or something. Anyway, Last of the Mohicans. Basically, he's this white man who's been raised by Native Americans, obviously called Indians. And even when we go back to James Cooper, the writer, he knew that there were different tribes and communities of these Native Americans. And so the Mohicans, the Mohawk people, actually is a collective of a number of different groups. And this is where we literally get the Mohican haircut from, you know, shaved at the sides and sort of a big crest along the middle of your head, because that's what they did in terms of their symbolic cultural tribal sort of attire, shall we say. And it's made quite clear in the movie that, and indeed in the book, that we've got different Native American tribes sort of ranged against each other. And that was something that had been going on, well, you know, since time immemorial. You know, just because people are vaguely ethnically similar does not mean they're not going to fight. They're going to fight over resource. They're going to fight over infringement of territory and things like that. There is kind of like this myth, if you like, that the Native Americans were sort of peaceful. They, you know, they were like any other culture. They had slaves. Not all of them, but some of them. You know, so it's a complicated and complex society that is actually being sort of referenced. Maybe not in a referential way, but, you know, in a semi-accurate way. And to take at least that much interest to write about it as a white man in the 1820s, 10 out of 10 to Cooper on that, although he gets minus points for falling into cliche, calling them Indians and things like that. So he is a man of his time. However, by the 1990s, we're obviously more culturally aware of this kind of stuff. And clearly the reason why this movie got made and why it got a budget was because there was the monster hit of Dances with Wolves, another film that is really, really good. Another film surprisingly starring Kevin Costner, which is completely made up, but is a really fascinating story about this a man from the Civil War. He's a sort of a Union officer who goes basically to the frontier before the frontier disappears, and sort of initially is very skeptical about local Native Americans, and then ends up sort of, in essence, becoming the Daniel Day-Lewis character, sort of like going native with them and sort of like siding with them against the white settlers. That is an amazing movie. Again, I'm actually going to say it's better than Last of the Mohicans. And if you don't shed a tear towards the end of that film, a number of very sad things happen. For me personally, it might not be the most obvious one. I'm not going to say, I want to tell you, but I don't want to tell you, because if you haven't seen Dances with Wolves, it's a relatively long movie, but that is an amazing film. So anyway, clearly because that was a big hit and it was historical and it was sort of like very heavily featuring Native Americans, that became big business. And so Last of the Mohicans got to be made. But they're actually from two very different time frames, two very different periods. There's this idea of the Wild West. The Wild West only lasted maybe 20 years. The cowboys sort of driving cows across the country. Again, that sort of lasted maybe 20 years. You know, people obviously did become old, but in theory, you would not have become a young man coming into the ways of cowboying and then be an old man age sort of 65 hanging up your spurs. It was kind of a one generation deal. It wasn't something that was passed down father son, for example. Technology and also sort of society just caught up with it. But this sort of like, there is this sort of great piece of myth making. In Europe, we got the time of knights in shining armor. And in America, we got the time of the Wild West. And both of them are based on history, but both of them are completely distorted by legends, and it just wasn't like that during those eras. However, whereas we can say Dances with Wolves is during the Wild West, actually, Last of the Mohicans is more than 100 years earlier. So, when was Last of the Mohicans set? Well, it very clearly states right at the beginning, it's 1757. And you'll be pleased to hear that one thing that's been updated is the hero, Hawkeye, is no longer called Natty Bumpo. Well, let's face it, Natty, short for Nathaniel anyway. The only time they refer to him by his full name is Nathaniel Poe. So they took the bum out of it. You could say Daniel Day-Lewis has no bum in this movie.
Academy Award winner.
Thank you. And what's great about the movie is it's a mixture of historically accurate events and action, and there's also a romance in it. So it's one of these movies that's, and indeed the book, it's kind of got something for everybody in it. And again, definitely go out and watch it, okay? However, as I said, it's set more than a century earlier than the Wild West, and 1757 is an important year because if you're American, you may or may not know this, but this is during the French and Indian Wars. But if you're European, you're going to say this is during the Seven Years' War. Now, the Seven Years' War went from 1756 to 1763. So it did last 7 years, unlike the Hundred Years' War that lasted more than 100 years. Okay, anyway, the point is this. What's going on? Because in the 1750s, America is a British colony. It is not independent. We all know that sort of happened in the 1770s, okay? So Britain is still in charge at this point of the colonies of America. And in 1756, Britain and France and lots of allies on both sides. This can get...
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Very complicated, very quickly. I will try and make it relatively straightforward, okay? But basically, France and Britain in the 1750s were the two biggest imperial powers. And whereas they were close to each other in terms of, you know, the actual countries of Britain and France, they were also very close to each other when it came to their imperial possessions as well. Canada was French at that time. You've got Quebec, which is, you know, still they speak French there. And the reason for that is because, you know, it was the cornerstone of French imperial power in North America. And you had the whole of Louisiana with the Louisiana Purchase. It's complicated about that one. But the Louisiana they're talking about is much bigger than the state of modern state of Louisiana. It's this huge stretch from basically Canada down the Mississippi Delta to, you know, New Orleans. There you go. Another French name there. So it's this huge swathe of land, which was owned by the French, not by the Americans, not by the British. Now, obviously, Native America would technically say they owned the land, but, you know, let's not go there. We're talking about the time of empire, shall we say. Basically, let's not go into the triggers of the war, because really what it was about was France and Britain kept bumping up against each other in Asia, in North America, and obviously in Europe too. So there needed to be a showdown. And it turned out the Seven Years' War was that showdown between those two nations. And it's a cutting a 7 year story short, it turned Britain from an imperial power to the imperial power. You've got things like the Battle of Plassey over in India, where basically by the time the Seven Years' War was over, the entirety of Bengal was given over to British interests. I've got to be careful here. It wasn't technically run by the British Empire because it was run by the East India Company and would be for about another 100 years. But suddenly, when did Britain stop being one of the powers in India and becoming the preeminent power? The answer is the Seven Years' War. You know, when did France get kicked out of North America? The answer is the Seven Years' War. And there are some famous people in this. There's Clive of India, Clive being his surname, not his first name. That's a British general who fought out in India and basically won all his battles. There was one huge battle where the British forces were heavily outnumbered. But you'll be pleased to hear Clive wasn't just a smart general. He was just smart. And so he worked out that, you know, if we pay the other army more money than they're being paid at the moment, maybe they'll fight on our side, or at very least go away. And that's exactly what happened. So Clive was doing his thing in India. There's fighting going on in the Caribbean. There's fighting going on in Europe. There's fighting going on in North America. This is, by any stretch of the imagination, a world war. The campaigns are spreading over just as much territory as something like World War I, for example. A pretty amazing scope of what's going on here. And the pivotal year is actually a couple of years later, 1759, where pretty much everything that could go right for Britain does go right. That's where you get Wolfe, General Wolfe, capturing Quebec. He dies in the process, but the French at that point have no option. They've got to capitulate about what's going on in Canada. So that's how it becomes a British colony. And it's worth pointing out, at the end of the American Revolution, Canada was still a British property. And also at the end of the American Revolution, more than 100,000 American colonists felt themselves more British than American and left America to live in Canada. And 100,000 in the 1780s is a lot of Americans. So I digress slightly. That's all going to happen a little bit later on. But in 1759, as I said, you know, so the successes in North Africa, sorry, North America, there's successes in India. Some key battles are going on there. There's also an amazingly epic battle that happens between the French and British navies. Now, a few years earlier, I love this story. There's this Admiral Byng, B-Y-N-G, of the Royal Navy, and his job is to go to the Balearic Islands, you know, Ibiza and those sorts of things. So it's relatively near Spain. And the French had invaded, and basically he turned up, he had an inconclusive fight with he had a small fleet, and he had an inconclusive fight with the French fleet, but he realized that while the French fleet was there, it's going to be almost impossible to land the sort of marines and recapture the island. So he sat there with his officers and basically said, so what should we do? We could go back to Gibraltar and we could re-equip and sort of fight them again and do a better job next time, or we could try landing, which could end up in failure, or, you know, there could be other options, keep sort of like try and blockade it or something like that. In the end, they all agreed to go back to Gibraltar and try again. When they got back to Gibraltar, Byng was basically released of his duties, and he was basically sent to London to face a number of different charges, including cowardice. However, ultimately, most of the things were dropped, most of the cases were dropped against him, and, you know, as an admiral, he would have been a wealthy man and well-connected, and everybody assumed that basically he would get a slap on the wrist and that was it. But he was specifically found guilty of not doing his utmost. And because of that, kind of shockingly, he was ordered to be shot. And so he was put onto the deck of one of his ships. He was allowed to hold up his own handkerchief. And then as he dropped the handkerchief, he was shot dead. Voltaire, even French writer and sort of satirist, even wrote in one of his plays a passing line going, you know, the British like to keep themselves motivated by shooting the occasional admiral. This really did shock everybody. Probably Admiral Byng the most, but why am I mentioning all of this? Because a few years later, we've now got Hawke, the leader of a Royal Navy fleet, who's up against the French near a place called Quiberon Bay, which is a big bay in western France. And there is a huge storm surging. Now, if you look at sort of naval engagements, almost all of them are fought in good weather because it's very hard to shoot in rough seas. And, you know, you got Mother Nature to worry about rather than cannonballs. But he had the French fleet on the run, and unbelievably, he ordered his fleet to follow the French fleet into what they thought was the safety of Quiberon Bay. Quiberon Bay, obviously, as a bay, it was more protected from the harsh seas, but also it had shoals there. And, you know, it was almost insane. The French were so surprised that the Royal Navy continued chasing them into the bay that they were caught completely unawares. Now, nobody knows this for a fact, but there is sort of like general opinion that Hawke, the reason why he went for it is was in the back of his mind is he has an opportunity to do his utmost. And the last guy who didn't do his utmost and played it a bit safe ended up being shot, you know, Admiral Byng. So he went in, and it turned out to be one of the biggest Royal Navy successes and victories ever. You know, it wasn't really eclipsed until we get to Trafalgar a full generation later. Now, it is worth pointing out that during the Seven Years' War, there are a number of players that pop up in later times, do sort of like start their military careers here. There is a very young Nelson, obviously not a lord at this point, started his career at the tail end of the Seven Years' War. Also, in America, you've got somebody leading one of the militias, a lieutenant called George Washington. Now, this brings us all neatly back to the Americas, because we call it the Seven Years' War. As I've already said, the Americans call it the French and Indian War because it was largely that the French had more soldiers in North America than the British did. The British largely had militias. And there were a very small amount of, you know, red jacketed, you know, British soldiers, but the French had far more regular soldiers there with like cannons and so on and so forth. The French were better equipped. Both sides, however, we're talking 1750s here, North America, particularly the East Coast, is largely one gigantic forest. And so both sides use Native Americans to sort of bolster their forces, to help find their way through the forests, to perhaps prepare ambushes against enemy troops and things like that. It did lead to, you know, you've got lots of settlers at that time, and if the men are out fighting, you've just got the women and children at home, and there were a number of raids. This is actually shown in the movie, or, you know, these are Native Americans attacking farmsteads. They're attacking them partly out of opportunity, partly out of revenge. You're on my land, for heaven's sakes. But that doesn't really excuse the execution of civilians, okay? And this is, again, a sort of like slightly uncomfortable conversation, because there's no doubt that the Native Americans, you know, everybody loves using at the moment modern morals on things in the past. And, you know, you basically everybody in the past was racist, okay? And in the 1750s, nobody had abolished slavery. So, you know, everybody's a racist slave owner. And the Native Americans, you know, it was part of their traditions and cultures to actually have hunting parties against sort of like enemy groups. So they were waging war in a way that made sense to them, but is definitely queasy to the modern listener. So, yeah, so there were massacres, local populations, but also something that, you know, George Washington ended up becoming kind of important for history. I think we can all agree on that. He's been lionized. There are all these myths around him, like I cannot tell a lie. He never actually said that. Or, you know, I chopped down the cherry tree. Never actually happened. He had wooden teeth. No, that's not true either. Anyway, so that, you know, there are silly stories about him, but there are also sort of like great stories about him. And he did lots of impressive things. But one of the things even sort of like his defenders find very difficult to support is during the Seven Years' War, the French-Indian War, he was a lieutenant in charge of some Native American militias, sort of soldiers, if you like. And after a battle, he basically lost control of them and they scalped and massacred a number of prisoners of war, French prisoners of war. That's not good. That doesn't look good for anybody, but particularly if we're going to sort of pretend that George Washington is some kind of military genius. You know, military geniuses don't allow massacres to happen, okay? Let's sort of sidestep that for a moment. Another fun fact is the US Army Rangers. You know, these are some really tough guys, specialist forces which exist today in the US Army. They were created for the French Indian War. So the very first US Army Rangers were actually working for the British and would have considered themselves, you know, American British colonists, which I find kind of an unusual sort of counterintuitive thing. But if you like, the cornerstone, the thing that took them so much time to film, they ended up having to put loudspeakers around this huge area where they'd sort of set things up in the movie of Last of the Mohicans, was the genuine siege of Fort William Henry. This genuinely happened in 1757. The French cannons, they brought in cannons and mortars to pound away at this largely wooden fortification, which was held out by a small amount of British regular forces, and then American sort of colonial militia were also there. And spoiler for the movie, spoiler for history, the French win. Now, what's interesting is we then have this very sort of European way of finishing a battle, which also kind of confused the Americans at the Siege of Yorktown in the 1780s during the American War of Independence, where after all this fighting between the French and American militia and the British in Yorktown, and then the same thing happened here, you know, they basically come out, they exchange pleasantries, and they're allowed to sort of like march away with their flags held high. It's like, hang on, didn't we win? But what happens both in the movie and happened for real is that as the British forces were leaving, they were attacked, they were set upon. We basically have another situation, just like I mentioned with George Washington. The Native Americans descend on these people who had surrendered, they'd finished the battle, they are massacred. Now, the exact numbers are interesting because James Cooper in Last of the Mohicans, he's very much of the time where Native Americans are savages and basically, and yeah, he didn't have the first-hand reporting of it either. So he basically makes out that about 1,000 people are massacred. Now, the real number seems to be closer to 100. I think we can all agree that's 100 too many, but it's an example where we actually get a piece of real history put in the middle of a fictional story. Now, by the end of the war, as I said, the French had ultimately lost huge. Interestingly, in Europe, nothing changed. The territories didn't change at all. And we needed somebody to keep fighting the French in Europe. So it's good job that we'd allied with Prussia. And their leader at the time was this guy called Frederick the Great. So it's good job that we've got a you know, a guy called the Great on our side. Frederick the Great, during the Seven Years' War, just fought an obscene amount of battles. He didn't win them all, but at some points he was fighting on three different fronts between the Russians, Austrians, and French, and he won more than he lost. Prussia was locking down France in Europe so that we could fight in the rest of the world. And going back to the American War of Independence in the 1770s and 80s, our biggest flaw, Britain's biggest flaw in that battle, because actually, if you look at how the British forces did in America, they did okay. But the point is, we had no European ally. So France could pour all their resources into stirring up trouble and supporting the American colonists because they didn't have to worry about the equivalent of Frederick the Great then. So if you like, the Seven Years' War is it's sort of like the dry run for the American War of Independence. You've got a lot of the same players, but, you know, lessons had not been learnt by the British, but absolutely by the end of the Seven Years' War, Britain was the supreme power. The last thing I'm going to tell you about all of this is occasionally you will see Queen Elizabeth II riding around, not in an open-top carriage, but in this huge, monstrous gold carriage, which has got a gold roof on it. That was made for George III, who became king during the Seven Years' War. This is the interesting thing. George III was in three different wars. The Seven Years' War, big victory for Britain. The American Revolution, big loss for Britain. And the Napoleonic Wars, big win for Britain. So he didn't do that badly, although he was really a figurehead. But in honor of the victory, that carriage was made for George as celebration, and it's so heavy, it weighs more than a ton, that the six horses that pull it cannot pull it uphill. It's impossible. So they have to make sure it's always on the flat. Also, it can't be going down a steep hill because that thing will pick up speed and smoosh the horses. So anyway, there we go. We've talked about movies. We've talked about history. We've talked about smooshing horses. We've talked about acting careers and different styles of acting. Lots and lots of things put together. This is why I love doing this podcast, because, you know, you start with a thing and it fires off into lots of different areas, and I really hope you found it interesting. Last thing to say is, as always, please, please spread the word, spread the love. Tell just one other person, you know, perhaps create a link to this podcast and tweet it out or put it on Instagram or Facebook or whatever. But please spread the love, because, you know, we're working hard for you, and all we want in return is just for you to keep spreading the news. Thanks very much, and speak to you soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.